Capital Market Insights from ICMA.
Good morning, everybody, and Happy New Year. I'm joined today by Robert Parker, the chair of AMIC, to do a podcast on 2021. So it's a very difficult exercise. And we've learned that from last year because things look terribly differently from January 2020 to the end of the year of 2020. So it's going to be a difficult exercise, but Bob is an expert in that. Bob, good morning again. And maybe we could take a look a bit about the macro figures and then deep dive into other topics by looking at the growth forecasts for 2021 across the globe.
Yes, absolutely. Yes, and good day, everybody. The growth forecast, most researchers and most economists are looking for a growth rebound after the 2020 contraction. And most of the forecasts are clustered around a global growth recovery of between 5 and 6%. Now, obviously, the year starts on a difficult note, notably in the US and Europe, given the increased cases of coronavirus and the problems in curtailing the coronavirus. And obviously, that was a dominant issue in the contraction in the global economy in 2020. But if we look at 2021, I think that growth forecasts of between 5 and 6% for the global economy as a whole are perfectly reasonable. And, I think a number of factors there. The first factor is obviously that consumption got hit very hard last year. And in contrast to previous economic and financial crises, consumers have built up very significant savings. And for example, in the United States, the savings ratio is close to 13%, whereas the historic average is around 4%. In Europe, in the Eurozone, the last quarterly figures showed a rise in consumer savings quarter on quarter of close to 25%. So there is a very high level of consumer spending power. Consumer balance sheets generally are in reasonably good shape. And, as restrictions perhaps towards the end of the first quarter and going into the second quarter are reduced as the vaccination programs on the coronavirus are implemented, then I think we could see pent-up consumer demand resulting in quite a strong trend increase in consumption, and particularly with that very high level of savings. I think a second factor is that although unemployment has risen in most economies, government employment schemes, what is called in the UK the furlough scheme, being very successful employment support schemes in a number of Eurozone countries, and most notably Germany and Scandinavia. That has meant that the rise in unemployment, which could have been dramatic, actually has been subdued. And again, that is supportive for consumption going forward. I think another factor which is positive for global economic growth in 2021 is the corporate sector. And two issues there is that obviously investment spending was very subdued in 2020. But there is, again, rather like there is pent-up demand in the consumer sector, there is pent-up demand for increasing investment spending in the corporate sector. And that's against a background of very low bond yields and interest rates and credit availability for borrowing and obtaining funds for investment spending. And obviously against a background of very strong equity markets, with that equity market rally from late March 2020 onwards, and a number of equity markets such as the DAX and the S&P, and in Asia, the CSI 300 in China, all of them have recently reached record levels. So therefore, equity financing for investment spending is cheap and is available. So I think that a surge in investment spending against a background also of very strong rebound in corporate earnings growth. And just two examples is that in the United States, the consensus that is that industrial corporate earnings growth will approach 80% year on year in 2021. And in Europe, in the Eurozone, the consensus, which I think is correct, is the corporate earnings growth will approach 40% year on year. And that's obviously after record contractions in 2020. So I think, aside from, monetary and fiscal policy, which we will talk about in a bit, the consumer and the corporate sector looks reasonably strong. And therefore, I feel that after a somewhat difficult start to the year for still challenges in dealing with the coronavirus, as we approach the second quarter, we probably will see a sustained improvement in global growth, which could well be extended for the whole of the year.
It fascinates me that we can do some growth projections given the uncertainty on COVID and on the vaccine rollout. How is it factor in those growth forecasts at global level? And how could this maybe impact some different growth rates if you look at different regions?
I think the first point to make on the coronavirus is that, yes, there are pockets of problems in Asia. So, you know, more recently, we have had a minor outbreak in northeast China. There have been outbreaks or increased cases in Tokyo and a few other areas near Tokyo in Japan. And more recently, an increase in cases in Malaysia and Indonesia. But I think the point on Asia is that, first of all, these are sort of localized problems. And I think the other point is that the authorities have learned that quick and effective action is important. And that is exactly what has happened. So I think the first answer to your question is that it is a general assumption that the coronavirus will not hit Asian growth going for the whole of 2021. And that's why, you know, the IMF forecasts, for example, of close to 8% growth in China, over 8% growth in India, and 6% growth for the ASEAN 5 countries in Southeast Asia. I think those growth forecasts are right. And, you know, with Asia still being very much the growth driver in the global economy in 2021. If one looks at Europe and the United States, we can talk about changes in fiscal policy in the United States, but a number of forecasters in the US have recently revised upwards their growth forecasts. The Federal Reserve is still forecasting growth in America of 4.2%, and I do think that we will probably see consensus forecasts being gradually increased over the next 1 to 2 months to close to 5% plus. You know, there are some forecasters, such as our friends at Goldman Sachs, who are now forecasting US growth in excess of 6%. Now, rather like Europe, in the United States, the more optimistic growth forecasts assume that the coronavirus numbers, which have increased in December and early January, will probably peak in late January and February, and that the vaccine programs will be implemented fairly aggressively. And, you know, if one looks at, you know, the vaccine tracker numbers, vaccines are now being given in over 40 countries worldwide. And, you know, certainly so far in January, a number of countries, and most notably the US, the UK, and, you know, certain European countries, we are seeing quite a fast ramping up of the vaccine program. So built into those numbers for Asia, for the United States, which I mentioned, the growth forecast for the Eurozone from the ECB is 3.9%. That's somewhat more pessimistic than the consensus forecast, which is over 4.5%. And, you know, the factors for the Eurozone, if we do get 4.5, possibly even 5% growth in the Eurozone, you know, that I think does assume that the vaccine programs are rolled out fairly aggressively in the first quarter of this year. And it assumes that, you know, a very significant part of the US and the European populations are vaccinated by mid-year. So built into these assumptions, and obviously there are risk factors around them, but built into them are the key assumption is that the coronavirus is successfully curtailed really by the second quarter of this year, and therefore restrictions can slowly and gradually, you know, be removed probably in March or April, and that we will get a near normal return to economic reality during the second quarter of this year. Now, obviously, one risk factor is that we have seen some mutations to the coronavirus. And one question is, do the existing vaccines deal with those mutations? And so far, the evidence is, yes, they do deal with the mutations. But, you know, that doesn't prevent another mutation coming up, which, you know, may be a challenge and which the vaccines may not be able to address. So there are risk factors, but the central case is that Asia leads growth, that we will see a rebound in US and European growth really starting towards the end of the first quarter and certainly accelerating in the second quarter. But the key assumption is that the coronavirus gets curtailed really sort of over the next 3 to 4 months.
So Bob, you started to mention some potential risks, and maybe it is not yet a risk, but could be potentially a risk. Inflation, is inflation about to take off, and how could this impact monetary policies in the year to come?
Well, I think the first point to make is that you've got to make a distinction between headline inflation, which includes food and energy costs, and core inflation, which excludes food and energy. And, you know, as we go into the second quarter, I think inevitably we are going to see a jump in headline inflation and a number of factors behind that. In April in 2020, West Texas intermediate oil prices were negative. Brent oil prices went as low as $20 per barrel. Today, Brent oil prices are over $55 per barrel. I think, you know, as we go into April this year, there's a high probability that Brent oil could easily test or exceed $60 per barrel. And, you know, as a result, there is a base effect from that tripling in oil prices, and that will feed into headline inflation. You know, likewise, if we look at food prices, currently, if we just take corn, for example, as a proxy for food prices, corn currently is trading at over $5 per bushel. And, you know, this time last year, corn was trading at about $3 per bushel. So, you know, we've seen that quantum jump in corn prices. That, in turn, will feed into food inflation, and that, in turn, will boost headline inflation. So, you know, if one, for example, looks at the Eurozone, where headline inflation at the moment is still very subdued indeed, and at the end of last year, year-on-year inflation, in fact, was negative. But, you know, as we go into the second quarter, I think there's a good probability that headline inflation will exceed 2% year-on-year, and investors, frankly, are not focused on that jump in inflation. Core inflation, which is what central banks focus on, I think will stay subdued until we see the impact of global growth starting to result in demand and cost pressures on inflation. And that, I think, will probably be later in 2021. So if we look at the fourth quarter of 2021, I think there's a high probability that given the acceleration in growth that we have talked about, the core inflation in the Eurozone could be approaching 2%, which is what the ECB wants. And in America, could be approaching 2.5%, with headline inflation potentially at 3%. So there will be that lagged effect between core inflation and headline inflation. But I do think the trend, which will probably start in March or April of this year, will be a trend increase in inflationary pressures. Will inflation get out of control? I think the answer is certainly not, but we're looking at a very different environment from what we saw in 2020, where obviously the major risk was one of deflation rather than inflation. And I think the overall theme is that deflationary risks are now behind us.
Does it mean that we won't have a taper tantrum this year? What does it mean for monetary policy? Is there a lot of leeway and a lot of room for central banks to be supportive when it comes to their monetary policies?
Well, clearly we have that major easing in monetary policy with, you know, cuts in interest rates, notably by the Federal Reserve in 2020. But the big move on central bank monetary policies in 2020 was quantitative easing and the expansion of their balance sheet. So, you know, if one just takes the Federal Reserve as an example, their balance sheet at the end of February last year was just over $4 trillion. It's currently around $7.3 trillion. And we've seen a sort of similar increase in the ECB balance sheet. And, you know, the Bank of Japan balance sheet is now close to 130% of Japanese GDP. And if you actually add up the balance sheets of what we call the Big Four, and the Big Four are the Federal Reserve, the ECB, the Bank of Japan, and the People's Bank of China, the total balance sheet there is around $28 trillion. So, you know, what happened to monetary policy in 2020 is very clear indeed, i.e. low or negative interest rates and a very substantial increase in asset purchases and in balance sheet expansion. I guess, you know, that monetary easing was highlighted by the last ECB meeting where they increased what they call the pandemic emergency purchase program from 1.35 trillion euros to 1.85 trillion euros and extended the maturity or the length of the overall program. Now, I think the message from central banks is very clear, which is they are going to be, in our jargon, behind the curve. What that means is that they will tolerate for some period of time, and that could be, you know, a good 6 to 9 months, above target inflation. And, you know, in various speeches, both Jerome Powell and Christine Lagarde have been very clear that, you know, they will only raise interest rates potentially 2 to 3 years away. And therefore, the probability of an interest rate increase in 2021 is very low. Having said that, I think, you know, given the growth and inflation outlook that we have described, there is a high probability towards the end of 2021 that the degree of asset purchases will slow down. So I think one thing that the Fed and the ECB want to avoid is what we saw in previous years, what was called the taper tantrum, where the Fed cut back on quantitative easing and that resulted in an unwanted market shock. So, you know, any action taken by the Fed or the ECB or other central banks for that matter, I think is going to be very moderated, and they won't actually reduce quantitative easing, but they may well slow down in the second half of the year, and particularly at the end, in the fourth quarter, the rate of increase in asset purchases. So I think a slow, let's not call it tapering, let's call it a moderation in quantitative easing is likely, which of course that policy action would be totally justified given the outlook which we've described for growth and inflation.
Maybe now looking at the fiscal side, are we expecting more fiscal stimulus from governments in Europe, in the US, or across the globe?
I think the first point to make is that in Asia and in Europe, we saw throughout 2020 very major fiscal expansion. And, you know, even with the growth numbers that, you know, we have described, budget deficits across the Eurozone will probably total around 7% of Eurozone GDP. And, you know, in Asia, Japanese budget deficits will probably be well above 10% of GDP. And the Chinese budget deficit is coming down given the growth recovery. But even so, it'll probably be close to 5% of GDP. Now, with the expansion in fiscal policy in Asia and in Europe, I think it's probably fair to say that fiscal policy outside the United States is very much on hold, i.e. the fiscal expansion has occurred. And actually, I think the need for further fiscal expansion probably is very limited. So I think the action is now behind us. And in Europe, you know, that was highlighted by the successful agreement to the EU 7-year budget and also by the announcement, which has had a very positive effect on European markets, of the European Recovery Fund of 750 billion euros. And I think it's just worth making 2 points on the EU Recovery Fund. That means that the EU is already issuing bonds in its own name. That takes pressure off highly indebted countries such as Italy, and we've seen that removal of pressure reflected in the narrowing of Italian bond spreads relative to bunds. The other factor is worth noting on the EU Recovery Fund is the 250 billion out of that 750 billion will be raised in the form of green bonds. And there is very much a focus in the EU budget and the recovery fund on addressing environmental sustainability and climate change issues. Now, switching to the United States, we obviously have, you know, an incoming Biden government. There was a quite difficult fiscal program pushed through Congress at the end of 2020 of $900 billion. I think there is a consensus amongst economists and certainly amongst the incoming Biden government that $900 billion was inadequate. And, you know, therefore, I think in February, a further fiscal program will be introduced, probably close to around $1 trillion US. And that is one of the reasons why growth forecasts for America have been upgraded on the assumption that we have that further fiscal boost. I think within the US fiscal program, a number of similarities with Europe. There will be a focus, the incoming Biden government, on investment spending in infrastructure. There will be a focus on investment spending in alternative energy sources and also addressing climate change and trying to reduce carbon emissions. So, you know, that environmental agenda that we see in the European Union will be replicated under a new US government.
What does this mean for the market? I mean, we have some good rebound of growth, some limited moderation of monetary support, and potentially, at least in the US, another round of fiscal stimulus. It seems like the perfect scenario, provided that indeed a vaccine will be rolled out and work efficiently against the new variants that we've identified. Does it mean that the market should just go one way, you know, invest more money in equity? What does it mean for the market in 2021?
Well, clearly there is a lot of discussion at the moment as to whether we have market bubbles. And the definition of a bubble is where investors have very concentrated positions. A lot of their positions are financed with leverage and where valuations are excessively high. And I think another example of a market bubble is where there is a lot of opaque risk factored into markets. And, you know, clearly one can look at certain areas of the equity markets where there are bubble-like characteristics. I would mention the increased use of what are called SPACs, special purpose acquisition vehicles. There is obviously been a big jump in IPOs and, you know, certain areas of certainly the US equity market and to some extent the Chinese equity market, certain sectors, you know, still IT, still consumer discretionary, you know, the valuations are by historic standards very stretched indeed. Having said that, I think there are some grounds for ongoing optimism. And, you know, if one looks at the growth numbers which I described, if one looks at the outlook for corporate earnings, you know, corporate earnings growth in America over 20%, in Europe, close to 40%, similar for Japan, and in China, corporate earnings growth, you know, at around 25%. So the corporate earnings numbers look good. The economic growth numbers look good. Obviously, there are areas which are vulnerable to correction. And I would just sort of focus on, you know, one area which has been a strong outperformer in 2020 in the coronavirus period, obviously has been the IT sector. The IT sector, we've seen very strong corporate earnings growth in 2020. That is going to moderate in 2021. So corporate earnings growth in China, Japan, Europe, and the United States is going to be well less than 20%. And in the US, most estimates are that corporate earnings growth in IT is going to be less than 15%. I think another factor is potentially increased regulation of the IT sector. You know, whether it is Europe putting forward proposals for a digital tax, whether it is, with some justification, Democrat Biden proposals for increased regulation of social media and the IT sector, and also, you know, a review of whether the IT sector in America has oligopolistic power in terms of its economics. So I think there, you know, clearly there are grounds for being more cautious. But if we look at sectors such as industrials, such as materials, such as the energy sector, and within the energy sector, the subcomponent of alternative energy, those sectors which are correlated with improving growth, and that would also include the consumer sector, there, I think there are grounds for saying that we will see equity market performance continuing to be very strong. That, of course, is against a background where it's very difficult to put forward a case for fixed income investment, where in most markets, real yields are still negative. And, you know, even in the United States, with 10-year US Treasury yields now above 1%, they're still well in negative territory in real terms if we have inflation heading above 2%. And, you know, likewise in Europe, with 10-year Bund yields of minus 50 basis points, even if they go to zero this year, we're still going to be significantly negative in real terms. So, you know, the fact that fixed income as an asset class, it's very difficult to be positive on fixed income when we have these negative yields. And therefore, by default, I think investor flows will be pushed, you know, furthermore into global equity markets.
And so you start to touch on fixed income and bond yields. Do you see them trending higher in the year to come? We've seen some pressure recently on bond prices. Is it a manifestation of profit taking, or what is it about? Is it a trend that is about to become a longer trend for the year?
Well, I think the first point to make is that if you look at historic patterns of real bond yields, going back, whether it be sort of 20 years or even 50 years, it is unusual to have negative real yields. And the norm is that real yields for most government bond markets are slightly positive. So I think factor number one is that investors will be discouraged from investing in government bond markets while that negative real yield environment continues. With the growth and inflation forecasts, which we have described, that factor clearly is negative for bond markets. I think in addition, if we get some moderation, as we've described, in quantitative easing programs, that means that there will be, at least at the margin, less support from central banks for bond markets. So I think this sort of nudging up in yields that we have already started to see inevitably is going to continue. So, as we go into the middle of 2021, I don't think it is unrealistic to talk about a 10-year US Treasury yield of around 1.5%. And with 10-year bunds moving back to close to zero, and with 10-year JGBs potentially moving to 20, 25 basis points positive. So I think, the trend in yields is up. Having said that, we still have these central bank backstops. And, consequently, I think the trend is going to be slow. And I think that although they're very cautious about what they say in public, I think all major central banks will try and prevent a major or sharp sell-off in bond markets. Although I don't think they're going to resist what we're seeing already, which is this gentle uptrend.
What should we expect from the currency perspective? Do you expect the dollar to continue downturn, or do you expect it for it to be stabilized?
Yeah, I think the first point to make is that foreign exchange market volatility has recently declined. And, with the euro, which was strengthening quite rapidly at the end of 2020, has now stabilized around 1.21 against the dollar, with yen moving back from around 103 to 105, and sterling, which a lot of people were concerned that we would see volatility over Brexit. In fact, sterling is very stable indeed, both against the euro and on cable against the US dollar. So I think first point to make is that foreign exchange market volatility is low. I think that that will probably continue. And a number of factors recently have emerged which are more supportive for the US dollar. The first factor is the bond spread between US Treasuries and bunds and JGBs. So if we look, for example, 10-year US Treasuries versus 10-year bunds, that spread is now close to 170 basis points. So that widening yield differential is dollar supportive. I think another factor is that whereas the fiscal expansion in Europe and Japan has now largely occurred, another fiscal program in the United States boosting US growth should be dollar supportive. And of course, we shouldn't forget that at the end of last year, positions in the foreign exchange markets were very long the euro and very short the US dollar. So I think all of those factors suggest that after a period of US dollar weakness, certainly in the short term, we are in for, I think, a period of stability in foreign exchange, and that US dollar weakness is probably now behind us. That, of course, is a view looking out over the next 3 to 6 months. Later in the year, it's entirely possible that we could see a renewed dollar weakness, but I think it's premature to make that call. And I think the key point is that the downtrend in the dollar is now likely to have a pause in the short term.
And maybe one last comment on commodities. They've performed really well since, I believe, April.
Yes.
I remember when was the oil crash, but do you see this trend continuing with the growth rebound for the year to come?
Well, if we break commodities down into, four components, first of all, energy. We've seen OPEC Plus moving very cautiously on expanding new supplies. We've seen OPEC Plus, and particularly Saudi Arabia, trying to take a more aggressive stance on those countries which have not been complying with their quotas. And I think the overall theme is you're not going to see a dramatic increase in oil supply from OPEC Plus. The incoming Biden administration, I think, are going to increase regulation on the US shale industry. And you know, that is part of the climate change and environmental agenda. So I don't see much of an increase in supply from US shale. So I think overall, the oil demand supply situation, which of course was exceptionally weak last March and April, I think now is becoming increasingly tight. So I think it's inevitable that we will see Brent prices, currently trading at around $55 a barrel, will break higher and potentially, you know, move above $60 a barrel in the first half of 2021. If one then moves on to looking at industrial metals and use copper as a proxy for the industrial metals universe, copper has moved up from a low last year in April of below $5,000 a ton. We're now above $8,000 a ton. That is driven by the improvement in demand, and most notably Asian demand. And if we get, as we think, Chinese growth, you know, close to 8% this year, that means that demand levels will remain high for industrial metals. And therefore, it's entirely possible that copper prices, although they've come a long way, that we do trend higher, and you know, price levels of $8,500 per ton are entirely possible. I mentioned earlier on the rise in soft commodity prices, and most notably corn. That, in fact, is an unfortunate consequence of climate change. And the more difficult climate conditions we have, that can have negative implications for harvests and the new supplies. So with an improvement in demand and with a difficult supply situation, I suspect soft commodity prices certainly hold the gains that we have seen in the last 6 months. And then finally, gold. And gold is a very emotive issue, and a lot of people at the moment are looking at gold versus Bitcoin. I think, you know, just one comment on Bitcoin. A lot of people have rehearsed, you know, the arguments for Bitcoin. I would counsel caution, because although I think there are sort of clear reasons for Bitcoin having an elevated price, there is clearly a speculative bubble there. There are very heavy concentrated investor positions. And you know, the volatility of Bitcoin, I think, is worrying. And obviously, that comes with a word of caution. And you know, the comparison between gold and Bitcoin, I think there are a whole series of reasons to question that comparison. But if we see inflation edging up, that should be supportive for gold. So although, you know, the curtailment of the coronavirus takes out part of the reason for owning gold, the rise in inflation should be supportive. So gold has been very volatile. I think there are reasons for saying its volatility will come down, but, you know, a major reversal in gold prices is unlikely.
Just a follow-up question on Bitcoin, because I think the, you know, since the first bubble of the Bitcoin and crash, people are saying, you know, the second time now you have like some institutional investor looking into it. Do you think it could potentially become a serious asset class? Maybe not for 2021, but in the long term, do you see any evolution regarding the category of investor essentially looking at this asset?
I think there are a number of very fundamental questions which have not been answered properly. We all know that Bitcoin is a payments mechanism, but is it really an asset class? And, you know, if one makes the comparison with gold, which, as I mentioned earlier on, I question that comparison, but, you know, gold does have some industrial use. Gold is obviously a major element of demand in gold is in the jewelry industry. If you look at other industrial metals commodities, they all have demand from real activity. Question number one, is Bitcoin a payments mechanism or is it really an asset class? And I don't think that question has been answered properly. Second question is that if you have confidence in a currency, one aspect of that confidence is that a currency is not volatile. And you know, as we have seen in Bitcoin, its volatility, it is now one of the most volatile aspects of the financial markets in late 2020 and early 2021. So I think that volatility does question its credibility. I think, no, the other question which needs to be answered is, what are the key factors that drive demand and supply? And is the supply of Bitcoin really fixed, which of course is one factor that Bitcoin proponents look at? And so I think that, you know, until we get good, solid, researched answers to those questions of volatility, clear analysis of demand and supply, and a clear justification for Bitcoin being an asset class, I think that it's not going to become a widely used currency. Now, if its volatility calms down and, you know, we look at, you know, its relationship with the euro or the dollar being relatively stable, then it could well become a widely used payments mechanism.
And maybe to finish, a very broad question, so apologies for that. What do you expect to be the main challenges for the asset management industry for the year to come? And is there any opportunities that asset managers should be excited about?
I think there is, in an environment of strong corporate earnings and strong growth, I think there are going to be, you know, a lot of interesting, profitable opportunities for asset managers. Now, having said that, I think a couple of challenges which will continue. The first is, you know, the move into indexed or ETF asset classes. And, you know, that in turn puts the squeeze on asset management revenues. And, you know, that has been a trend that we have seen for some years already. I think that trend does continue, the trend towards indexation or passive management. I think the, you know, the other trend, which AMIC has been very focused on, is how asset managers can deal with pockets or periods of illiquidity in capital markets. And that's particularly an issue, you know, whether it be in mutual funds or ETFs, where the underlying asset classes experience illiquidity, whether it be corporate bonds or whether it be natural illiquid assets such as real estate. So I think liquidity, you know, which we have had a very successful working group on, I do think that that is going to be an ongoing challenge. So profitability, the need for economies of scale, asset class liquidity, I think are the major challenges. And that all links into, I think, further consolidation in the asset management industry. And there have been a number of research reports highlighting what I think is already well known to most of us in the industry, which is compared with other major industries, and particularly in the financial sector, whether it's insurance or investment banking or commercial banking, the asset management industry remains very fragmented. So I think further consolidation is likely. I think a final word to say is that, you know, the asset management industry, I think, has done overall a very good job, particularly in 2020, on risk management, and in addition has embraced fintech and has invested significant resources in IT to improve the services to customers. Obviously, those asset managers who have not made the necessary investments in IT, you know, are going to very much fall behind. So, you know, embracing fintech, I think, is a key aspect for the asset management industry. And, you know, many of the asset managers, you know, have done that successfully. So, no, I don't think it's a substantive problem. I think it's generally an issue which the industry is on top of.
Well, thank you so much. Just one last question. Can you give me some targets? So by the end of 2021, the level of the S&P, the price of the oil, and maybe 10-year treasury?
Okay, let's go oil first, which I would say, if one looks at Brent rather than WTI, I would say $65 per barrel. If one looks at 10-year US treasuries, I would say 1.7%. And then the S&P, probably 4,000. Now, all of that comes with a caveat that I don't like using the word guarantee. Whenever investment managers provide guarantees, they normally get themselves into trouble. But I can guarantee the single figure forecasts will always be wrong.
Bob, thank you very much for this very interesting podcast. I suggest we take stock of what happened at the end of the year and do another one. It was a pleasure to speak with you. Thanks for listening to us. And we'll be continuing our regular market podcast with Bob and other market participants through the year. So we'll be in touch very soon. Thanks for listening.
Thank you for listening. For more ICMA podcasts and further information on capital markets, please visit our website, icmagroup.org.